say, sir. We've done what you told us. We brought you the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. We melted her.
Ah, you liquidated her, eh? Very resourceful.
Yes, sir. So we'd like you to keep your promise to us, if you please, sir.
Not so fast. Not so fast. I'll have to give the matter a little thought. Go away and come back tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh, but I want to go home now.
You've had plenty of time already.
Yeah. Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz. I said come back tomorrow.
If you were really great and powerful, you'd keep your promises.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures, think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now.
Oh.
The great Oz has spoken.
Oh.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great Oz has spoken.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
Disillusionment. Maybe from your childhood you can recall those moments when someone or somehow a bit of the curtain was pulled back and a magical bit of childhood suddenly vanished. Maybe it was the year that you figured out something about physics and the North Pole and your house and a certain express gift delivery service. Or maybe it was that your budding skills as a young biologist suddenly brought you to a shocking realization about bunnies and eggs. Or maybe you remember losing a tooth with great anticipation of the magic that was to happen that night, only to awaken at the wrong moment, richer and yet disappointed. Maybe like Linus, you waited expectantly year after year for the great pumpkin to arise, only to suffer once again disappointment. Maybe it was a trip to the Magic Kingdom, the happiest place on earth, where you discovered that even there, you could get stuck standing in line for hours. You know, we love the promise of magical places, but so often our experiences are tempered when we discover that really there's just a man behind the curtain. Ambrose Bierce defined a year as a period of 365 disappointments. It's an easy stroll, isn't it, from idealism to cynicism. Someone has said that a cynic is simply a wounded idealist. I want us to take a look this morning at one such wounded idealist, a man whose idealism is often forgotten in light of his cynicism. Talking about the follower of Jesus known as Thomas, or more commonly known as Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas for his understandable failure to believe what by any reasonable measure is simply unbelievable, that Jesus rose from the dead. We don't know all that much about Thomas, really. We know that he was one of Jesus' 12 closest followers, one of his disciples. He's named in every one of the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And interestingly, every time he is listed as one of Jesus' disciples, his name appears along with two others. He appears with James, the son of Alphaeus, and a man named Matthew, that we later find out also is a son of Alphaeus, which causes some to think that perhaps Thomas was a brother to Matthew and James, though we're not sure. Only one of the Gospels attributes any direct quotes to Thomas in the Gospel of John. Only four statements that we have that originated with Thomas, but I think they tell us much. The first happens in the context of a return to the region of Judea. Jesus traveled around quite a bit during his ministry, and one of the places he had spent time in was Judea, and the first time he was there, he wasn't received well by the religious leaders. In fact, he was received so not well that there was actually an active plot afoot to put him to death if he ever stepped foot back in the region. It was within that hostile setting that Jesus received some troubling news. The news was that a good friend of his, a man named Lazarus, was terribly ill. And it was Lazarus's sisters, Mary and Martha, who sent word to Jesus because they knew that Jesus had healed many. And they said, "Lord, if you could, please come quickly. Our brother is very ill." Well, understandably, going into Judea was a high-risk venture, and common sense would say you shouldn't do it. And Jesus didn't. Jesus delayed his going. And yet Jesus framed his delay as something other than fear of being killed. He framed it as he was waiting. And the day came, after he had waited a bit, he said, "Okay, now it's time for us to go, because Lazarus has fallen asleep, and I must go wake him up." To which his disciples responded, understandably, "Well, if the guy's just sleeping, he'll probably wake up okay on his own. We don't need to go to all that risk for that." And Jesus clarifies. He says, "No, what I'm talking about is Lazarus has died." And Jesus' intent was to go and do something they'd never seen before, to resuscitate, to bring Thomas back from the dead. It was in that context that we come across Thomas's first recorded words. Thomas, loyal to Jesus, hearing Jesus now voluntarily going back to a place where they knew the religious leaders had vowed they were going to kill him, says this: "Let us go that we may die with him." What does that tell us about Thomas? Well, to me, it says that Thomas, at that point in his life, was all in for Jesus. He was a man who was courageous. He was a man who trusted Jesus implicitly. He's a man who was loyal. And if his leader was going to go and face certain death, Thomas said, "I'm with you. I'll make the trip." Well, the trip didn't turn out really as badly as Thomas had prepared himself for. It actually was a spectacular success. Lazarus was returned to life, and the crowds became electrified in their support for Jesus. They'd never seen anyone do something like this. The religious leaders still hated Jesus, and their plotting continued, but really they seemed powerless in the face of this grassroots groundswell of support for Jesus. From Thomas's point of view, he must have thought he had hitched his wagon to a shooting star. It just kept getting better and better. The next time that we read of Thomas speaking, it is at the event that we often call the Last Supper. For the friends of Jesus gathered there with him at that meal, they had no sense that this was any kind of Last Supper. They simply were there to celebrate the great Jewish feast of Passover. But Jesus did make and had made some comments leading up to the supper that were perplexing, to say the least. He told them that he was about to go someplace, and it was someplace where they could not follow him. It was Peter, another one of Jesus' followers, that didn't like the sound of that. And he argued the point, and he said that there wasn't any place that Jesus would go that he wouldn't follow, even if it meant following him to death, much like what Thomas had said. And yet Jesus made a rather startling prediction. He told Peter that not only would he not be able to go where Jesus was going, but he said, "You will absolutely deny and renounce me three times before this night is over." That must have made for some awkward silence. And then Jesus had this to say, John chapter 14. It says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to where I'm going." Which leads Thomas to his third statement. Thomas is listening hard. Thomas may be perplexed, but he is not apathetic. He is devoted to this man, Jesus. And so he presses the issue. He wants to know, "Where are you going? How do I get there? Lord, we do not know where you're going. How can we know the way?" To which Jesus responds, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You know, this is probably the single most divisive, alienating statement that Jesus ever made in his ministry. To people who were religiously sensitive, spiritual seekers, they could see there was something unique about Jesus. I mean, he said a lot of great things and spoke truth and modeled a life that showed that he was deeply in touch spiritually. And if he had just said, "I am a way to God," everybody would have been pretty much okay with that. We're all looking for ways to get to God, and Jesus looks like he could be a good one among a lot of options. We like options, don't we? We love diversity. I got a GPS in my truck that offers me alternative routes. I tell it where I want to go, it tells me what it thinks is the fastest route, but then it offers me other routes that I can choose from to get where I want to go. I upgraded to that GPS. I used to have an old GPS that only gave me one way. But I like options. And so I got one that gives me more choices. But you know what? Jesus didn't offer any alternative routes. For someone who is revered as a great moral teacher, his sense of spiritual options seems downright claustrophobic. He didn't mince any words. He said, "No one comes to the Father except through me." C.S. Lewis, commenting on this statement, said the following: "A man who is merely a man and said the sorts of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell." And yet somehow, coming out of Jesus' mouth, it didn't sound like the words of a crazy man. Well, if dinner was puzzling, what came after for Thomas and his friends was absolutely traumatic. The disciples followed Jesus from that dinner hall out to a place called the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus often went to pray. My guess is, after all this talk about "I'm going places where you can't follow me," that probably they followed a little bit closer just to be sure they didn't lose track of him. But they got out there, and Jesus stepped away from the group a bit and began to pray, but he was praying loudly. He was crying out. You could tell by the sound and by the words that this was a man who was in deep emotional distress and agony. And his prayer was that his Father, that God would, if possible, allow this cup to pass from him. They didn't know what this cup was, but whatever it was, it must be bad to cause their friend, their master, so much pain. But then it got worse. Soldiers showed up with torches. More troubling, at the head of that mob of soldiers was one of their own, another disciple named Judas. He led the mob and he turned Jesus over for arrest, and they realized that he had sold them out. And in the melee that followed, Thomas ran away. I imagine he just ran and ran and ran because nothing made any sense. Everything that he had thought was going to be true, everything he had anticipated, suddenly seemed to be nothing. And he didn't understand what it all meant. Throughout the night, things got darker. There were rumors of a trial and then a death sentence. And not just any death. death on a cross. A death so horrific that we draw our word excruciating from it. It literally means out of the cross. And then it was done. The man Thomas had been willing to die for was dead. And Thomas had made no heroic stand in his defense. The crowds that had sang Jesus' praises only days before had been replaced by those who jeered and cheered at his bloody death. The word on the street was that those who killed Jesus were on the lookout for his followers as well. And Thomas suddenly found himself no longer a semi-famous friend of Jesus, but a man hiding in the shadows without direction or purpose. A cynic is a disappointed idealist. The next words we hear from Thomas are those of a cynic. He still hung out with his old friends. They were all in hiding together, but one day, having been out away from them, he came back to the room they were hiding out in, and they all were excitedly talking, and they're saying, "Thomas, you should have been here. Jesus showed up right in this room. We saw him. He's alive. He talked with us." And Thomas said, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." You know, there are lots of things of far more consequence than jolly elves and bunnies that we lose faith in. Idealistic things that disappoint us. We get inundated with marketing, don't we? People promising us that they've got the new product, the new solution that will fix everything, that will cure our problems. And most of us have heard enough of it and been disappointed often enough that we are just grateful that we have the DVR. Because we can mute it, skip it, and move on. We just don't believe it anymore. But there are bigger things that we lose faith in. Family can be disillusioning. People scoff at that old TV show, Ozzie and Harriet. I don't think so much because what they modeled was bad, but because it seems so far out of sync with reality. We lose faith in marriage. We lose faith in our children. We lose faith in our parents. Politics will disillusion you in a heartbeat, won't it? It'll leave you jaded with empty promises and naked power plays. Even religion far too often seems like it is really just a haven for hypocrites and powerless platitudes. And we lose faith in ourselves. Rightly so. Stores are stocked full of self-help books because most of us don't think we're really doing all that well. I read recently of a guy that went into a store and he asked where he could find the self-help section. And the clerk said that she wouldn't tell him. He said, "Why?" She said, "That would defeat the purpose." We lose faith in our wealth and its ability to protect us. We lose faith in our education and where it can take us, what it can guarantee us. We lose faith in careers that we thought were going to fulfill us. We lose faith in our health as we recognize that we're getting older and our bodies won't always do what we want them to. And the question that many come to ask is this: is this all there is? I mean, really, is this it? I keep looking for the next big thing, but it seems like every time I get to the next big thing, it's not really that big a thing. Jim Carrey once said, "I wish everyone could get rich and famous and everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that's not the answer." Some of us find comfort in discounting all of it. A guy named Daniel Waters, not the Daniel Waters we all know here, but another Daniel Waters said this: In a cruel and evil world, being cynical can allow you to get some entertainment out of it. But there's a price to be paid for cynicism, isn't there? C.S. Lewis. You can't go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. To see through all things is the same as not to see. Oscar Wilde said that the cynic knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. You know, we really can't live that way, can we? Well, it may be fun to play the cynic sometimes, like I don't care. The reality is we can't live that way. We can try to take something even like love and chalk it up as nothing deeper than just an evolutionary coping mechanism. But when it comes to our own love of another, or the experience of their love for us, we know that there is something far more real and profound at stake than just biological tenacity. True love often leads to great self-sacrifice with no biological payoff. People willing to lay down their very lives for someone they don't even know, driven by love and compassion. It is love, not survival, that gives to life its deepest and fullest experience. And I believe there is a hole in every human heart that can only be filled by the love of God. We were created to have a relationship with God, and nothing can replace what God alone can fill in our heart. While the cynic may attempt to cover the hole with shields of brass and flippant answers and smug sneers, those things can never fill the heart. Fortunately for Thomas, his story does not end there. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Thomas, the disappointed idealist turned cynic, suddenly is confronted with the reality that he can't see through. He sees it for what it is. He sees his friend, his master, his Lord alive before him, beyond all reason, beyond all human understanding, and he recognizes that he is the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." We are those people, aren't we? People who have not seen what Thomas saw. But does that mean that we're only left with the prospect of exhibiting blind faith that flies in the face of all evidence and reason? Is that what it means to be a believer? If so, then I have a story to tell you about a rabbit and some colorful eggs, and you'll just have to trust me on that. But if you're a skeptic, I want to talk to you as a friend, because I have been a skeptic too. My own story, many of you know, was one of growing up in a devout Christian home, only to become profoundly disillusioned. I wasn't hostile to God. I didn't want him dead. I wasn't convinced that he existed. Or, if he did, that he really was anything like what I had been told. And those questions might have been just typical college-age angst, except that I wasn't a college student. I was a married father of three children, and I was a pastor. And churches don't pay pastors to doubt God. Well, I may have lost faith, but I at least wanted to hold on to character as though that really matters if there is no God. But I resigned my position, figured I needed to sort this thing out without my paycheck being attached to it, and I started my quest to discover once again, as an adult, if anything about this God story really made sense. That was a long journey. Don't have time for it this morning. If you want, there's that green insert in your bulletin. There's a website there called thefaithpuzzle.org. Some night when you can't go to sleep, check it out. That's got the whole story. But I want to focus in on one thing that was key for me. It was the same thing that was key for Thomas. And that is the question that arises out of today, out of Easter. Did the resurrection really happen? Because if the resurrection really happened, there are profound implications to that. And if it didn't, then we can just move along. There's nothing to see here. What I found was rich historical evidence that the central claim of Christianity is in fact grounded in reality. I can't give you all of the evidence for that. There are a bunch of resources on that insert, but let me give you just four starting points. The first one comes from outside of the Bible. A historian by the name of Tacitus, who wrote around 116 AD, what is called the Annals. And what I want you to see in this quote I'm going to show you is he affirms three things. First, Christ lived. Don't let anyone tell you that Christ was just a mythical figure that never existed. Tacitus affirms that Jesus lived. He affirms that Jesus died and that he died a horrible death, the supreme execution, crucifixion. And then third, he relates that something happened after Jesus' death that caused some kind of rumor to start circulating that something very strange had happened. Something that seemed almost superstitious was going on. And Tacitus doesn't believe it. He doesn't write this as a friend of Jesus. But he does affirm that these three things were true. Christus suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. Jesus died. A second strand that I find interesting is that the tomb was empty. And one of the evidences of that is that there was no veneration of the tomb. This was the common thing in the day. If a great teacher, a great rabbi died, the rabbi's followers would go and venerate, create a little shrine there at the tomb, a place where they could go and meditate on his teachings and honor his memory. And that would have been a perfectly normal, expected thing for a great teacher like Jesus to have happen. And yet it didn't happen. As much as he is respected, as much as he is revered, nobody built a shrine in front of his tomb. Why? Because for those early Christians, there was nothing there. That wasn't the place to remember Jesus because he was gone. In fact, it wasn't until AD 326 that Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine, identified what was believed to be the burial place of Christ, and they built a shrine at last, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It took 300 years before anybody thought it was worthwhile doing anything to memorialize the burial place. This year, for the first time in 200 years, that burial chamber has been open for inspection and renovation. You want to know what they found? Nothing. Well, maybe it was just a sneaky plot. Maybe those disciples, even though they were disillusioned, even though their lives were in danger, even though they had no expectation that Jesus could really come back from the dead, maybe they were just smart enough in their hiding place as hunted men to figure out that if they could steal the body and tell a big story about resurrection, that they could maybe still get famous off of this deal. Maybe get their own reality TV series or something. Maybe that's what it was. A third strand I would point you to is that these disillusioned disciples became diehard believers. And I do mean die hard. We're told that Peter was crucified upside down. In fact, every one of these followers of Jesus, except for John, died as martyrs. Horrible deaths. Now, let me just ask you a common sense question. If you have men who are thoroughly disillusioned with the man that they have been following, who fled for their lives and were in hiding, are these the kinds of men that you would expect to come back and tell a story that they know is false? They know it's made up, that the claims they're making that we've seen Jesus are not true. Live out their full lives, persecuted and ultimately dying horrible deaths, and nobody cracks and says, wait a minute, just before you nail me up here, I think maybe I could tell you where the body is. Every one of them went to their death convinced and testifying that they had seen the risen Christ. You have to explain that. Here's a fourth line of evidence that I find very interesting. Again, it comes from outside of the Bible. It comes from the land of India. India is a Hindu-majority country. It's nowhere close to Israel. And yet, in the middle of this teeming population, there is a population of about 6 million people living there who identify themselves as Thomas Christians. And they trace their lineage back to an apostle of Jesus named Thomas, who came to them a couple thousand years ago and proclaimed Jesus to them. And they became his followers. Thomas, the idealist, turned Thomas, the cynic, ended his life as Thomas, the missionary, because of what he saw. I don't know where you're at, why you're here. For many of us, maybe most of us, you're probably here on Easter Sunday morning because you're a true believer. You're a follower of Jesus, and his love, his life, his indwelling spirit has captured your loyalty. And for us, today is a day of celebration. Maybe you're just a spiritual person. And if so, I want to thank you for spending an Easter here to investigate Jesus, to think about him. But I want to challenge you that Jesus never was willing to be considered as just one more stepping stone on the path to our fulfillment. He said that he was the way, the truth, the life, and that no one gets to God any other way. That's not me being a religious bigot. That's just what Jesus said. And if Jesus really did rise from the dead, then I think we need to take his claim seriously. People who take Jesus seriously, who follow his way, find that rather than limiting life, it frees and it fills life. Maybe you're here because, like me, your nature is to be a cynic. You just aren't sure that anything really can be believed because you've seen the curtain pulled back one too many times. But what if it's true? What if Jesus really did what history claims? What proof would be enough for you? A friend of mine, a chaplain named Dan Nolta, works for a police department down in Pierce County, told a story of going to the door to talk to a woman. He had to give her some very important news, and as he stood on her door asking if she would let him come in and talk to her, she would not open the door because she didn't believe that he really was who he claimed to be. And so Dan first pointed out to her his uniform. There he was in full chaplain's uniform standing there, and she said, no, you could have bought that uniform any place. I don't believe it. So then he showed her his badge and his department ID. And she said, no, that could be faked. I still don't think that you're really him. So he showed her his radio, and he let her hear that there was radio traffic happening on his radio. And she's like, well, that doesn't prove anything. So Dan finally got an idea, and he said, go inside and call 911 and ask them if there's a Chaplain Nolte standing on your front porch. That time she finally believed him. I don't know what kind of proof you need to conclude that Jesus is who he claimed to be. But my Easter challenge to you, if you're a cynic, is that you would check it out. Gave you some resources on that insert. On Monday nights, 6 o'clock, we have a group meets here at the church called Alpha. It's specifically for people who have questions about faith to talk about it. Come and join us. We'll feed you dinner. But I'd say a word of caution to cynics. And leaning that direction myself, I understand this phenomena. Cynicism can become a bad habit that just blinds us to things that are really true. It can also become the excuse for cowardice or just laziness, because it's easier to smirk at everything than to do the hard work to really find out what is true. And if Jesus is who he claimed to be, I think it's worth the effort to figure it out. Let me close with a verse that comes from the book of Revelation. Jesus said, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me." Once you've done the hard work, I think you will come to the same conclusion that I came to, that he really is who he claims to be. And his invitation is that we open up the doors of our heart and we let him in. And he'll fill that hole, that place inside of us that only God can fill. And that would make this Easter the best Easter of all. He is risen. He is risen indeed. Amen.